Today is on English prose, and so last week we did poetry. Today we are going to do prose, and I wanted to make some key points. We're going to do a bit of history, again, just round off the kind of story. It's a bit of a mantra, but look at things like authorship, performance, audience analysis, prose style, its development, and look at some texts as we go through it. So, first of all, what is prose? Which is a fairly standard question. This may be the type of thing you got asked at your interview. Some definitions. Unstructured form of language closely connected with the rhythms of everyday speech. The form of written language that is not organised according to formal patterns of verse. Matter of fact, commonplace, dull, or you don't know. So we'll have, should we have a little lead in the first lecture? So a couple of minutes, just chat to your neighbour there and see what you think is the answer. Okay. Basically, if you'd been asked that interview, we'd have accepted any of the first three. The fourth one we wouldn't have accepted, of course, because they are actual definitions of prose, which you will find in the Oxford English Dictionary. We'll have a look at where it meant a second. Matter of fact, commonplace, dull is unfortunately a thing you associate with prose, particularly in this period, because some of the prose texts you may have come across, you think, well, what on earth am I reading this for? This is not literature. This is just dull, dull, dull. And I'm going to hopefully show you otherwise. Molière came up with a probably best definition. All which is not prose is verse, and all which is not verse is prose, which would not have got him into Oxford. But what he did, of course, there was the famous, I think, from the small bourgeois, whatever the play's called. For more than 40 years, I've been speaking prose without knowing it, which is that first definition that prose kind of follows the way we speak. And it is pretty much like that, as we will see. So, some common characteristics about prose and the types of things you'll come across in Old English. It's very factual, so it's trying to be convey facts, so therefore it has to be quite clear and simple. Explain or record things, so this is emerging out of the oral culture into a literate one. You need standard vocabulary, because if you're trying to explain something to someone, they've got to know what you're talking about. Fairly regular syntax, we've spoken about syntax before, word order, and easy to translate. It's not like poetry, it's not that web that you come across, it's a lot easier. So let's show you some prose. And on the front, on the handout, don't worry if you haven't got it, there's a couple more bits, we'll have a look at one of them. But this is from a writer, Alfrich, who I'll speak about a bit in a second. And just to show you how it follows. So here's the Old English, and here's the Modern English from the Temporibus Annie, and he's trying to explain natural events. So here he's trying to explain thunder, or thunor. So thunor comes of harten and of waten. Thunder comes from heat and from water. The sky, say a luft, tooth, thonor waten, draws the moisture to it from below, neodan and the harten ufan, and the heat from above. So he's trying to walk through. And if you see the Old English words, and the Modern English, you would say, they pretty much follow each other. It trots along quite nicely. And it's a lovely definition of thunder. And when they are gathered, the heat and the moisture within the cloud, then they contest between themselves and with an awful noise, and fire bursts out through lightning. The hotter the summer, the more thunder and lightning in the year, which is pretty much as it was. And a lot better than my mum, who told me it was God moving his furniture around when I was a kid. Okay, so now no Modern English, but I think you could probably, again, similar theme, talking about something. This is on your handout. Again, he's trying to explain something. So now remember, we read it out, listen to it, you might understand it. Rainus, rains, okay, cometh of, and I've told you what that means, Thara, so comes from the sky, exactly, as in Lufthansa. Sail, the sky, licketh, licks, and draws up watten, water, yeah, from Sheffield, you might say water, of Ealra earth, they do apparently, from all the earth, and there a sea, and the sea, and ye gathereth, gathers into shurum, showers, yeah, and when she, which is the sea, is of course a she, ne me nara aberen, so not may not more a barren, bear, exactly. Then fjolth Fealf hit Iduna, then it all falls down. Which again is a great, pretty accurate, isn't it? It's recognised, I can't remember the term, but the moisture is absorbed from the earth, drawn into the clouds, and then at some point it will all come down into rain and the cycle goes on. And he was trying to explain rain to the Anglo-Saxons, and he does a pretty good job of it. On your handout, which I won't go through, the top bit, you can try that because there's the manuscript, then there's the text, and it's the coming of Hengist and Horsa to to England. Well, it wasn't England, they were coming to Britain in any case. Okay, so how does Old English prose compare with poetry in sense of some key things? Well, first of all, we have titles of prose. So a lot of the text you will come across, when you see the title in Mitchell and Robinson, that is the title that the Anglo-Saxons had given to it. We have authors. We know some people who wrote prose. We know a fair bit about them. We don't have many, but we do know a few. We have dates. Pretty much we can tie some of the text to the authors, but the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, well, it can't have been written the year before the event took place, so we can start dating these things as well. We have lots and lots of prose, more than you probably would ever want to know about, but there is a lot of prose out there compared with, remember, 4 manuscripts of poetry. In poetry, only one copy survives, usually. There's a few exceptions. In prose, you often get multiple copies of the same text. Indeed, for example, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, I think there's 7 copies. Might have that figure wrong. As I just said, there, numerous copies survive. But it does throw up same similar questions about authorship, audience, performance and style, and some unique ones as well, which we're going to tackle. Okay, another little discussion thing for you to keep you awake. Do you agree or disagree with that statement? You can sit on the fence if you wish, so have a little bit of a chat to yourselves. We'll see how many Russian formalists we've got in here. All right, that'll do. So let's do a show of hands here, just see how many of you are new historicists. So how many would agree with that statement? Okay. I think the majority of you. So how many would disagree? Yes. Hang on in there. Yeah, okay. And probably you should all put your hands up and go, it depends on the text, of course. So fair enough. The thing which we tend to do in medieval studies, though, which is kind of ironic in a sense, is that we do focus on the context of the text. We are constantly trying to build up the context. And in the case of poetry, we don't know too much. But in the case of prose, we do. But what you may have a piece of literature and you just can't date it, you have no idea the author and the context, but then you start placing it in scenarios. Well, if it was written in this century, it might have meant this, whereas if it was written in this century, it might have meant something completely different. And that is the joy of this period, whereas, if you read a Dickens text, you know exactly when it was written and what he was writing about, because there are books and books and books written on the stuff. So let's give you a bit of history. Now, as you all know, I'm sure, there are several key important dates in English or British history. 1939, whatever, 1966, winning the World Cup. But of course, clearly, as you know, the most important date in English history is 878 AD. Now, for the one or two of you who didn't do history at school and don't know why 878 AD is the most important event in English history, I shall tell you. So just to fill in the story, we know the Anglo-Saxons arrived in sometime the 5th century. They conquered and expanded in the 6th, generally from east to west, started forming these kingdoms, Augustine arriving in 597, bringing back Christianity to England, because of course it was here before, and in the north the Irish monks were bringing Christianity of their flavour, etc. In the general scheme of things, if you want to simply remember, in the 7th century, Northumbria, the Northumbrian kingdom is the dominant one. There are multiple kingdoms. Then power shifts to the Mercian kingdom, which does extend as far as London, under a king called Offa, who you remember, built a dike, etc., etc. And then something cataclysmic happens in Anglo-Saxon history, and it is important for the development of prose. Namely, these guys appeared, the Vikings. And we move into what we call the Viking Age. 200 years, pretty much, of uninterrupted, to a certain degree, slaughter, mayhem, conquest, etc. And it wasn't just the Anglo-Saxons who were on the receiving end of this. Everyone was, all the way through Europe. They even got as far, possibly, as India. However, the Vikings have a major effect on all kinds of things. They are given a bad press. There are horrible stories associated with the Vikings. One of the most gruesome one, which, so I'll tell you it, is their ritual of the spread eagle, whereby they used to hack through the rib cage of the victim who was still alive and rip it open like wings of a bird and then display their entrails. By that time, I suspect they were probably dead. But it was a bit of give and take. This is probably not true, but anyway, it's worth showing up just because it's nice. What you're seeing there is possibly an example, probably not, of Dane skin, which is where the Anglo-Saxons used to skin the Danes alive and leave their skin hanging on a door. So not particularly nice thing to do. And you are in the city, of course, where there was the first attempted genocide in England, whereby the Danes were slaughtered on Sir Bryce's Day massacre and burnt alive after Ethelred's diktat that all Danes living in England should be slaughtered. So it wasn't a particularly nice time. However, for our purposes, by the end of the 9th century, there was a bit of a pickle because most of those kingdoms that you see there had been conquered or brought to more or less subservience by the Vikings. The Vikings didn't raid, they eventually came and settled, with one exception, holding out down there. In fact, you could even say the entire fate of the English nation rested for one short period in a marsh in Somerset, which indeed it did, because basically the one kingdom that was holding out right at the end was Wessex, led by a particular gentleman. Him, Alfred the Great. Now, Alfred the Great deserves his name, as we shall see. He was king of Wessex, and the reason why 878 AD is so important is that although he's reduced pretty much to scratching an existence with a handful of followers, in 878 he rallies his troops, comes back, defeats the Vikings, kicks their asses, sues for peace, and starts the reconquest of England. And if it hadn't been for him, we would all have been saying God Yule on Friday, because we'd all be Danish. He did not deserve what you're about to see, which is the only filmed version, not contemporary, of Alfred's life. And this is a 1969 film starring David Hemmings, which I will show you the clip of the Battle of Edington, but it starts with Hemmings rallying his troops. Oh, if you think you'd be rallied by this. Anyway, not a good film. In fact, an appalling film, and the only film attempt at Alfred the Great, one of the great heroes of British history, and he suffers that. However, the only interesting thing about the film is that it was made in 1969, and it was at the height of the Vietnam War, so what you're basically seeing is an anti-war film. So culturally, it's quite interesting, but that's about it. Anyway, so Alfred the Great and his sons and grandsons lead a reconquest of England. We get, under his initial victory, we get this line where England is divided into what we call the Dane law and England. That's why you can do place names, and you will see loads of places in this area named after Scandinavian suffixes, more in here in English. But everyone breaks the treaty, and gradually what happens is the Anglo-Saxons push them back all the way up to here, and eventually conquer all of England again. So that I think his descendant, Athelstan, you could actually say is probably the first king of England. He rules over the entire English nation. The borders are formed, which have stuck ever since, give or take a few miles. He even gets the subservience of the Scottish kings as well, so he's the first king of all of Britain. And pretty much that's the oldest kingdom we have in Europe. But Alfred's legacy, from our purposes. Once the Vikings have slaughtered everything, destroyed everything, he starts to reconstruct. He's a genius, this guy. He starts to build monasteries, and he really takes an interest in learning. In a text called The Preface to the Pastoral Care, he says, all the people who could speak Latin, could understand it, are all dead. Now all the monasteries are gone. We've got to sort this one out. We've got to get revitalised learning in England. And he pretty much sets out all the books he thinks should be written, but most importantly, in English. He says, everything should be written in English because that's what my people speak and understand, not Latin. So English becomes the language of the clergy and the court. So you will get translations from the Bible in English, in Anglo-Saxon that period. None of this heretical nonsense a few hundred years later. No, if you want people to understand what they're meant to understand, then why not put it in a language they actually speak? What a revolutionary thought. He himself translates or instigates translations of some major texts. You might come across these. The most probably interesting, a pastoral care is interesting, is that he translates the great medieval philosophical book, Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, which pretty much sets out medieval thinking for several hundred years. It was Boethius who put this idea of the wheel of fate, the wheel of fortune, that your life will get good and then it will get bad, but it might turn again, etc., etc., which comes through in the poetry. He provides history books, notably the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle starts in Alfred's reign. It goes back, it records stuff before that, but that's when it starts. He gets religious and philosophical books set out, such as Boethius, but there are others. And he builds a fortification system, remodels the army, and starts the Royal Navy. That's why he's great. But if we think about this, apart from the fact that English has risen to the prominent language of the nation, that pretty much what he set out is a national curriculum for England, which is a fairly revolutionary thought in the 9th century. These are the books he wants all his noblemen and their children to read and understand, because it will make them better people. Okay, let's finish the story off. As I said, England is reconquered throughout the 10th century by the House of Wessex, not the House of Fraser. There is a period in the middle of the 10th century when everything goes quiet. It's quite peaceful under King Edgar. And we have what's called the Benedictine revival there. And that's when the Benedictines, the monks, pretty much take over the land. There's more and more monasteries built. These are the famous saints that lead it. And they do some quite interesting things. They start disseminating, writing lots of texts, disseminating them around the country. And that's where we get two of our great prose writers, which we'll talk about, Alfred and Wulfstan. Unfortunately, it doesn't go too well. They lose control under Ethelred Unrad, which you know the joke. Ethelred Unrad, do you? Hey? Oh, he's not unready. Everyone says, oh, he's unready because he was caught unawares. No. Unrad. That means advice. That means ill advice. Ethelrad. Noble advice. Noble advice, badly advised, which he basically was. It wasn't his fault he lost. Anyway, Canute takes the throne, goes back to Edward Professor, 1066, and all that. So that's pretty much what happens. But why is this important? Because now, if we say, well, we don't know when Beowulf was written, but how would Beowulf have gone down with people in the period of Alfred, when the Scandinavians are pretty much slaughtering their aunts and uncles and all their children? Probably not so well, or under Athelred, when they're getting slaughtered. It might have gone down pretty well under Canute, because he is, of course, a Scandinavian king. So these things feed into what we're talking about. Why does language standardise under the late West Saxon, late 10th century? Because Wessex had conquered all of England. And then what you get with the Benedictines, they all want to talk the same language. They pretty much, this is again a revolutionary concept. They say, this is how we are going to spell English. Everyone should spell it like this. They standardise English. It all goes to pot once the Normans come, and we spend centuries and centuries, even up to the time of Johnson, trying to resort this one out. But they standardise English. And why do we say English literary prose begins with Alfred? Because, of course, he starts it all. There were prose texts before, as we will see, but he does start it all. So the quote from Bately in the Cambridge Companion to Old English Literature: it's a significant literary achievement, the Anglo-Saxon establishment of vernacular, i.e. English prose, as an acceptable medium, is absolutely true. But before we leave history, let's have a bit more Hollywood, shall we? So we're going to go to the 6th century. This is an appalling clip, but it's funny. All right, anyway. By that, they would not have had horns on their helmets. It's a really stupid thing to do, because someone only has to hit the helmet on the horn, your helmet goes off, you're vulnerable. Really, really dumb thing. Victorian's idea. So what prose text do we know? Anyone, what have you done? St. Edmund. You say that with joy and happiness unbound. Okay, Alfred is St. Edmund. The Old Testament, translations for the Old Testament, good. All right, well, there's plenty more, as we will come across. Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, a famous one. Okay, well, there is a lot of prose, as I said. We have about 3 million words, not unique words, of Old English. 93% of them are in prose text. 6% poetry, 1% glosses. There are no drama texts. There's no theatrical texts in Anglo-Saxon England. The nearest thing they had were processions in churches where people said things from different parts, and that is possibly the precursor to drama. What we have is literary and non-literary prose. So let's give you some examples of prose. probably won't do these, but these, this is in the old English, law codes. So laws are written in prose because you want to convey the law to people. Law codes you might think are very, very boring, but they're actually very interesting. So the first law code, 695 AD, they were formalising their legal system by then. And this can tell us a lot. If a servant, contrary to his lord's command, performs servile work during sunset on Saturday evening, sunset on Sunday evening, he is to compensate his lord 80 coins. So we know there was a servant-lord relationship. If a husband sacrificed to devils without his wife's knowledge, he is to forfeit all his property. If a slave, we know there are slaves, sacrificed to devils, he is to compensate 6 shillings or be flogged. So we also know there are slaves and there is witchcraft going on in the 7th century. Law codes, quite interesting. This, you think, what on earth is this? This is what's called a charter, and you may think, the eagle-eyed say, that's not Old English, because this is in fact Latin, and that's Latin, but the smaller text is actually Old English here. And charters pretty much defined a boundary of land. So it would say, you start here, you go around here, 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 you come back, that's the area of land. And that's why we have the thing, beating the bounds. You used to take the small children from the village, walk around the bounds of Regation Tide, beat them, so you didn't actually beat as in walk, you'd beat them physically, so they would understand, and that's how people remembered land charters. And these things were written down, and that was proof of ownership. So, a charter, a good one, from London. First, erst up Thames, first up the Thames, after the old ditch to the cow ford, the bridge where the cows go across, up and lang, Teo Burnan. Now, Burnan is a river or a stream, so that is the Tyburn. There isn't a river here, is there? It's underground in London now. To the wide army street, so it was the street where the Roman army used to walk along, to the old Stocken Sancta, place of St. Andrew's Church, and then along the Hollow Stream. Anyone guess what that is in London? Holborn, exactly. And then along the streams by the land and by the Strander. A strand is a place between water and land, and it is, of course, the Strand in London. And you can follow that walk. I mean, it's an awful map, I'm afraid, but you can actually follow that walk, and that was a bit of landholding. Most amusing thing is the cow ford, the place they used to get the cows to walk across the bridge, is Buckingham Palace. Okay, science. So they used to write books about science. The liver is extended on the right side as far as the pit of the belly. It has 5 lobes of lappets. It has a hold on the false ribs. It is the material of the blood, the house of nourishment of the blood. When there is digestion and attenuation of meats, they arrive at the liver and then they change their hue, etc., etc. Now, I'm not a medic, but that's not a bad description of a liver, and at least it gives you the impression that they were interested in science. They were interested in travel. This is a travel book. If you're going on your holidays, don't go here. There's a giant bloke with 2 heads who eats people. Or there are camels. What they do with the camels here? The camels aren't your problem. It's the giant ants that are the size of the camels that are the problem. So you would read that book and look at the pictures and go, I don't think I'll be going there this summer. Science, again, more science. Here it begins to tell about the nature of man, how he becomes man in his mother's inside. First, the man's brain is formed. Then in the 6th week, the brain is covered with a membrane. In the 2nd month, the veins are formed. Separate 3, 6, 5, shorter and longer. This is the formation of the fetus inside the womb. So they had obviously observed this, or they picked this up from previous studies, and they were interested. It does not say a stork comes along and drops it behind a bush. They were actually at this level of understanding. They get it obviously slightly wrong, because it turns into a mortal sickness in the abdomen, most often on a Tuesday night. Okay, you might think this is silly. You might know which kind of a child a pregnant woman will give birth to. If she walks slowly with hollow eyes, she'll give birth to a boy. If she walks quickly and swollen eyes, she'll give birth to a girl. Take 2 plants in hand, blah, 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 blah. Ask her to take whichever of the plants she wishes. If she takes a lily, it'll be a boy or a girl. If she frequently eats nuts or acorns or any fresh fruits, then sometimes it happens that as a result, the child is stupid. Again, you will go to, I'm sure you've heard these stories, oh, you're going to have a boy, oh, you're going to have a girl. Those things still go on. And what they are saying there, they'd worked out there is some link between the diet of the mother and what the child might come out as. Superstition, if a man dreams that he sees an eagle settling his head, that means much honour. I like the last one, if he sees bees carrying honey, it should prove to be earning of money from wealthy persons. So they're taking what you dream about and try and apply some meaning to it. Ha ha ha, stupid Anglo-Saxons, no one would do that in the 20th century. Of course they do. Okay, authorship. Prose does originate from literate culture, therefore authorship is often at a time and a place and usually by an individual. And we know who these individuals are. My little trumpet men. I often play Led Zeppelin at this time, but I can't do for copyright reasons. So some of the writers you will come across, Beatfith of Ramsey, who writes a sort of book on how to calculate Easter. Alfred the Great, we've already mentioned, from the end of the 9th century. Wulfstan of York, who writes sermons, etc. These slides will all go up, so don't worry too much. He's the Archbishop of York. By far and away, the most prolific writer is Alfred Germain. He writes a giant corpus of texts, and he is an absolutely fantastic writer. Living around the end of the 10th century, down near Cerne Abbas, founder of the ancient abbey just up the road, so he's buried up there somewhere. However, anonymous. We still don't know a vast chunk of who wrote them, but we can make guesses, etc. And I've included one text there because it was right towards the end of the period. It's called Apollonius of Tyre. You may have heard of that title. And it's pretty much a novel. It's just approaching a novel. So maybe they were moving into that. And then, of course, we have loads of people who just write in Latin. Anglo-Saxons who are very adept at writing in Latin. Very prolific. But it's not that simple. Mainly because of these two chaps. These are the people who complicate things. Don't say "ah." You may think nice, you may think dinner, whatever. Anglo-Saxon would look at those and think manuscript, because they're the things that we carve up and make into manuscripts. Animal skin. Vellum is strictly calf skin. You might hear that term. Usually, if you can really get the good stuff, it's an unborn calf, because it was really, really good. And one of the fields you might go into if you carry on this is studying manuscripts, studying the book, codicology, or the paleography. There are about 90 manuscripts surviving from the period. And we know how they were made. There are lots of constructions, and there's a lovely riddle telling you how one is made. An enemy ended my life, stripped me, etc., etc., like that. We've seen manuscripts before. That was the ruin, if you remember. So some of them are in pretty bad state. This one is one we haven't seen before. I don't know if you can... Anyone want to guess what it is?
The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle.
It is. Well done. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. So you have a date down here. So this is an entry for a year. That's why it says here, in this year. It means here, in the margin, in this year, this is what happened. And what I like about this is that someone has gone through and underlined words at a later date, and these are actually place names. Wintanchester, Winchester, and our very own Oxnaforda, where someone's underlined it because they were trying to learn Old English. If you didn't know, by the way, Anglo-Saxon Oxford, which means the bridge of the oxen, wasn't very big, but it was here. So you're talking about up by, what's that, the Martyrs Memorial, down there, down to St. Aldate's. That was pretty much the size of the city, with some farms and settlements around. But manuscripts cause us a problem. In a manuscript culture, no copy is the same because someone's copying from something else. So it's prized, as is the authority of the source of the text. But copying itself is not degraded as it is in the print culture, where we prize originality. There's a textual fixity in print which there isn't in the manuscript. So let me give you an example of that. So supposing we have an author, he writes his little book or his little thing. The scribes then make copies from that. Then those copies are then copied by other scribes, and off these things go. And at each point, the scribe can make errors. But more importantly, at each point, the scribe can say, "I don't agree with that," and change it completely. So the idea that they could fit in or change text to suit their audience, their context, etc., completely throws the whole concept of authorship. They probably didn't prize authorship as much as we do, which is why Barth has said this about the death of the author. It emerges from the Middle Ages, but it's not really there in the Middle Ages. Well, later Middle Ages it is. Okay. How was it? Who were the audience and performance? Well, I've tried to give a table here, and I won't go through it, but these are a range of all the things you will come across in Anglo-Saxon prose. And if we just think of who they would have been interested in, well, obviously the rich people, the noblemen, the administrators, the clergy would have been interested in key texts, such as homilies and sermons. The freemen, that is the people who aren't slaves, would have been interested in laws and charters, obviously. They might have been interested in... Well, if it's sermons, they would have heard them. And it would have been a mixture. Sometimes you would have read a book in private. Sometimes you would have gone and heard this if you were a monk in a monastic office or at mass. And sometimes at school, because they did have a schooling system where they would educate people. It does develop. So our early stuff, Anglo-Saxon Chronicle 592, in this year there occurred a great slaughter at Woden's Barrow, isn't very complicated, but... towards the end, Alfrich, right, in 10th century, the Holy Mother Mary fed that child and it grew, just as other children do without any sins. It's much more complicated style of prose. And sometimes they don't get it quite right. It's a bit clumsy because you will come across what we call parataxis. I'll give you some examples of that. The famous one is, I came, I saw, I conquered. But the Anglo-Saxons would probably have said, I came and I saw and I conquered and then I did this and then I did that and then I did this. And it kind of feels like a child writing for the first time. But they're learning. So, example, King Athelred and his brother Alfred fought against the army at Meriton and they were in two armies and there was a great slaughter on either side and their bishop Healhman was killed. And it trots on like that. So the clause structure, etc., was they were learning it. They don't get action very well. If you've done Cynewulf and Cynehard in the Anglo-Saxon chronicle, it's a bit complicated. And Latin, of course, is a much more developed language for these things, so they struggle when they're translating from Latin to English. But they do some good things. Rhetoric has become a buzzword now, hooray, thanks to this man, who has... Well, as we will see, is an advocate of rhetoric and obviously a student of rhetoric. Mind you, if they'd elected a beach ball compared with the previous guy, we would all been celebrating. Rhetoric is the ability to convey a meaning and do it effectively to your audience. So we will pick not, this isn't Obama, this is Martin Luther King. And if you remember this famous speech, let freedom ring from the State Mountain of Georgia, let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee, let freedom ring. You can see what he's doing. He's repeating here. And when this happens, when we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring, there is a lot of devices being used here which we would class as rhetorical training. And Obama did exactly this with his inauguration speech. When there was despair in the Dust Bowl and depression, using alliteration, across the land, she saw a nation conquer fear itself with a new deal, new jobs, and a new sense of repetition. Yes, we can. America, we have come so far. We have seen so much. But there is so much, etc. He was using rhetorical device, and he continues to do it, as Churchill did, as great speakers do. And the Anglo-Saxons did this because they were trained in rhetoric at school. So this is Wolfstand, not quite as thrilling, perhaps, as Obama's inauguration speech, but it's probably been read by more people. There is eternal burning grimly mingled, and there is eternal terror, there is eternal pain, and there is trial and tribulation, and always continual misery. There is Etche Brinna, grimmer ye mentioned, and there is Etche Grira, there is Etche Acha, and there is Sorgung and Sargung. So he's using rhyme, again, because he was delivering this from a pulpit to make you listen, go, oh, and it would get in. So this is rhetoric, so you're getting this in prose as well. Lovely, Edmund. Someone mentioned they'd done it. So, another development, this was Alfred and Wolfstand. Here we have St. Edmund. Edmund the Blessed, King of the East Angles, was wise and honourable, blah, 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 blah. But if you look throughout the prose, there's alliteration all the way through. Eardmund se eardiger easting lecunning, was snorter and worthful and worthed a simlum in adelum thearwam don almichtigen God. He was eardmund and yethungen and swa anrader, thurwoneder, that he'd know that abugen bismuthulum leachtrum. It's written down, you probably would have read this, but they're using ideas from poetry to make it memorable, and this is what we call rhythmical prose, which Alfrich was great. How do you analyse prose? Think of the standard way I used to do, but also think like an Anglo, walk like an Anglo, think like an Anglo-Saxon. Again, it comes from their training. It's a little rhyme, but I wouldn't recognise you remember that. But what it's showing you here is when they were writing the complicated prose, not the law codes here, they had different levels. So there was a literal level, the letter, there was an allegorical level, there was a moral level, what you should do, and then there was a spiritual level, what you should be looking for. And you will see Alfrich, when he talks about a text from the Bible, he will then start dividing it up into those four and beginning to work on it. We call the moral level tropological, by the way, but don't worry too much about that. The other thing is they were drawing on sources. So what was the source text? And you can go away and look this up. You can be reading Edmund. You will know that he copied that from another author. But they changed it. So why did they change it? What was important? All these things come into play when you're analysing prose. And what devices does the writer use? How advanced is the prose? Are we seeing things like rhythmical prose? Are we seeing rhetorical devices? So it takes it to another level, in a sense, when you're analysing this form of literature. But, as I said, you're not going to get it with the law codes. Okay, I'm rounding up. I've done quite well on time. This final quote here, it's a bit naff of me, basically. Alfred's biblical translations are like a pool of water that people have dipped into from time to time as has suited their needs. This is the sort of crass thing you write in a PhD thesis, and indeed this was what I wrote in my PhD thesis about 20 years ago on Alfred's biblical translations. So allow me the experience of wisdom over 20 years. Old English prose is like a pool of water that people have dipped into from time to time as has suited their needs. And what I'm just trying to say here, and what I was kind of trying to say in Alfred in a very bizarre and ham-fisted way, is that a lot of people dismiss prose because you want to read The Dream of the Rouge, you want to read The Wanderer, you want to read Seafarer, you might want to read Beowulf, or at least watch the film or whatever, because that's poetry, and poetry, hey, poetry's good. And indeed, poetry is the older form of literature. Prose develops later, as we have seen. But the prose is very, very good. Not only can it be entertaining like some of those things and quite amusing because it gives you little glimpses into their lives, but also it has been taken to a new level. It has been taken to quite an advanced level in terms of the devices they were using, and it was beginning to show development, as I said, with Apollonius of Tyre, into the novel. We already have short stories, and then we're moving into that, perhaps that genre and that medium. And who knows what would have happened if they hadn't lost at Hastings. Maybe that whole idea would have developed far quicker than it does now, moving into things like we get in Old Norse, like the sagas. So, in summary, it begins with Alfred, who is seeking to re-establish learning after the Vikings. This is prose, that is, and the Navy, if you're interested. Most Old English prose is covering factual documents, but it's varied. Some of it's nonsensical. Some of it is undoubtedly literary. Those sermons, those homilies, those saints' lives, biblical translations are literary. And then you add the philosophical texts like the Consolation of Philosophy, etc. We do know about the authors, or more about them, more authors certainly than the poetry. We know a fair bit about the audience because this fits into so many things we know about the monastic office and other things. And we know, and therefore we know quite a bit about performance because these were important documents. We still face issues of authorship, as I've talked about the manuscript transmission, which does throw up all kinds of problems. But it was well developed. It's easy to read, hopefully, and easy to translate. Is it any good? Yes, of course it is. Go and read it. So, next week, it's the final lecture. It's fifth week. You've got tons of essays to do, so it's kind of light. I mean, they probably are all light. But anyway, this is the Bring the Popcorn one. Welcome to medieval land. We're going to take you through the history of what happens to Anglo-Saxon and Old English after 1066. The reuse by later writers going way up into the 20th century. Portrayals of the Anglo-Saxons, and we are going to find out what the contributions to Old English were by Alfred Hitchcock, Steven Spielberg, and Leonard Bernstein. Thank you very much. Thank you.